This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran reiterates its seriousness about reaching a good and strong agreement to revive the 2015 deal and urges the U.S. to avoid ambiguous literature in the text of a potential deal. Queen Elizabeth Britain's longest reigning monarch dies at the age of 96 after 70 years on the throne, her eldest son Charles succeeds as the country's king. And the U.S. approves another massive weapons supply to Ukraine worth over $675 million. Washington plans even more arms deliveries amid the war with Russia. Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran says it is still serious about reaching a good and strong agreement should the American side avoid using ambiguous literature in the text to revive the 2015 deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks during a phone call with his Chinese counterpart. He emphasized it as a condition to reach a stable agreement in the shortest time possible. Elsewhere in his remarks, Amir Abdollahian exchanged views on bilateral, regional, and international issues with the top Chinese diplomat. Wang Yi, for his part, stressed Beijing's interest in further expansion of ties with Tehran. He highlighted Iran's reasonable request, that is, in JCPOA talks rejecting unilateralism in international arena. Two ministers also discussed issues on lifting Western sanctions. Queen Elizabeth II, who reigned for more than 70 years as a British monarch, has died at the age of 96, with her son Charles now succeeding her as king. In a statement, the Buckingham Palace has announced 10 days of mourning. It says King and Queen consort will remain at the Royal House in Balmoral, Scotland, before returning to London on Friday. National flags at Windsor Castle and other government buildings have been lowered to half-mast after the Queen's death was officially announced Thursday afternoon. Officials, including newly appointed Prime Minister Liz Truss, mourn the passing of the monarch.
We are all devastated by the news that we have just heard from Balmoral. The death of Her Majesty the Queen is a huge shock to the nation and to the world. Queen Elizabeth II was the rock on which modern Britain was built.
Truss said the Queen had been a personal inspiration to her and many Britons, adding that Britain grew and flourished under her reign. World leaders have also paid tribute to the Queen and expressed condolences to the British royal family over her demise. Elizabeth was the longest-serving monarch in British history. Her reign began back in February of 1952. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to tell us more about the challenges the new British monarch will face after ascending the throne.
Charles is really getting on in age, and you don't know me, that this family has quite an age longevity, of course, as we know. But how long will his reign last? Will he be able to make that kind of impact? He's also, don't forget, now presiding over a very different kind of Britain that's emerging. What with all of the energy crisis and the world in flux as we see it around the globe today, Britain is also going to have to find its own way with the Brexit scenarios, with the relationships with China, America, etc., to balance the war in Ukraine. He's coming into a world which is probably equally fraught. I mean, the Queen herself came at the tail end of the Second World War, of course, and he's also going to have to deal with a complete change in the type of society that we're living in, the information age and the biotechnological age, the age of transhumanism, the age of, if you like, all sorts of modern technological advances will have its own challenges.
Calls are growing in former colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Now that after the ascension of Charles to the UK's throne, after the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed unease about the passage of leadership from Elizabeth to Charles. There are doubts over the role a distant monarch should play in the 21st century. In Jamaica and the Bahamas, people are calling for reparations and an apology for slavery. This while Barbados, one of a dozen Caribbean nations which are Commonwealth members, ditched the Queen as head of state last year. Jamaica has signaled it may follow suit. A survey shows 56% of Jamaicans favor removing the British monarch as head of state. Activists in the region also argue that Charles's ascension is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery reparations. A disturbing trend of violent anti-Muslim attacks has rocked the English city of Leicester over the past few months as locals claim radicalized Hindus are roaming the streets on a weekly basis, hunting down vulnerable Muslims and assaulting them. Leicester, which boasts a sizable Asian community, has witnessed a number of assaults with Muslims falling victim to such incidents. Robert Carter headed to Leicester to investigate, that is, these claims.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, Press TV was informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs radicalized by foreign extremism. At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community. Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religious groups, especially Muslims, who've become a prime target of India's Hindu extremist rhetoric. Local activists informed us that they believe it's the same Hindutva hate which has caused the rise in Islamophobia here in Britain.
The Muslims and the Hindus in Leicester have been getting along for decades. We've not had no issues. It's these latest crowds of these young Hindutva ideology thugs, RSS, the BJP thugs. This mentality, they come with this mentality, they're trying to bring it down here, and they're very, very racist, and they're the ones who are causing the problems in the community.
This year, at least three severe attacks have occurred, with at least two victims being hospitalized. The media has so far only focused on a recent outpouring of anger by local Muslims, venting their frustrations via scuffles with the police on Monday night. But if the alleged problem of Hindu radicalism isn't dealt with soon, Muslim vigilantism may become the go-to option for some furious locals. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Now the U.S. has pledged another massive military package for Ukraine amid the ongoing war with Russia.
And yesterday, the president approved the latest tranche of U.S. assistance to Ukraine, valued up to $675 million.
Package will include more ammunition, Humvee trucks, and anti-tank systems. Announcement was made during a meeting of defense ministers at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The U.S. has also unveiled nearly $2.7 billion in new military support for Ukraine and those neighbors Washington says are under threat from Russia. The Foreign Military Financing Program involves offering loans or grants to other countries to buy U.S.-made weapons. A State Department official says half of the new package will go to Ukraine and the rest to 18 other nations, including Moldova and Georgia, as well as several Baltic states. North Korea has passed a new law which officially declares the country a nuclear weapon state. Now, according to state media, the new law outlines the country's nuclear policies. It'll rule out any negotiations over Pyongyang's denuclearization. Also, the country will not distribute or share nuclear arms with other countries or transfer nuclear technology or materials. The Korean leader has described the new status as irreversible. The nuclear weapon states, or the NWS, are the five states, including the U.S. and Britain, which are officially recognized as possessing nuclear weapons by the NPT. Pyongyang's legislation comes amid signs the country has completed preparations to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. The death toll from flash floods in Pakistan continues to rise as people struggle to cope with the devastating impacts of this natural disaster. Authorities have reported 12 deaths in the past day. This brings the total number of fatalities to 1,355, which includes nearly 500 children. People in some parts of the country are building barriers against rising floodwaters that have engulfed nearly a third of Pakistan after weeks of rain. Flooding has disrupted the lives of nearly 33 million people and is estimated to have caused losses of about $10 million. Hundreds of thousands have been forced from their homes as well. The World Health Organization says more than 6 million people need humanitarian assistance in flood-stricken areas. UN has also called for $160 million in immediate aid. Now back to one of our top stories, where North Korea has passed legislation which officially declares the country a nuclear weapons state. Now to find out more about this new law, we're joined out of Seoul by Jennifer Chang. Hello, Jennifer. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. Tell us, what does this legislation really mean? And is it just basically what's already been prescribed now on paper in form of law? Or does it really change anything when it comes to the policy on the country's nuclear situation?
Well, it does change things because previously in the Constitution, the nuclear weapons had been enshrined, the development of them by North Korea. But this adds to that by describing the circumstances under which the North can use these nuclear weapons, namely when it is under the threat of an attack or invasion, or there is a possibility of an attack with weapons of mass destruction or an attack on its strategic assets. So this means that South Korea and the U.S. have to be extremely careful. Now they are conducting military drills again for the first time since 2018 when U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held their first historic summit. Of course, those negotiations fell apart in 2019 at their second summit in Hanoi. But since then, there have been no military drills in the field, but that happened this year for the first time since that summit between the U.S. and the North in Singapore in 2018. So this means that the North can actually strike such a military drill, for instance, if it believes that the military drill is more than just a military exercise and is about to attack a North Korean nuclear facility, for instance, or a missile testing site. An invasion is sometimes more likely to happen during a war game because there are so many soldiers and members of the military, servicemen, at the site of the military drill. And of course, these involve tens of thousands of troops at times. At times, they have involved hundreds of thousands of troops. So the North is warning the U.S. and the South not to get too aggressive in their military maneuvers and their calculations of whatever kind against Pyongyang, because now the North is going to respond with nuclear weapons. And of course, South Korea does not have nuclear weapons, and it is reliant on a nuclear umbrella from the U.S., and it is depending on an ally, which may not be there forever.
Right, and Jennifer, and it also seems like with all the stipulations and when we could use it, what we could allow to do with it, what we're not, it's almost like the North wants to get some kind of relevance in its nuclear program. It's like pushing this legislation to say we want to be a recognized respected and relevant nuclear power state. If you have nuclear weapons, you handful of other countries, and you're not considered a pariah, why should we be?
Exactly, because the U.S. and South Korea are insisting that the North give up nuclear weapons before any relief of sanctions by the U.S. and by the U.S.-led United Nations and any unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and South Korea can be lifted. And the North is saying that this is hypocritical. Why do we have to negotiate by giving up our nuclear weapons when other nuclear weapons states do not have to do this? We should also be recognized as an official nuclear weapons state. And more pressure is building on the U.S. and South Korea to do just that, to negotiate with the North on its own terms.
Right. And Jennifer, it's funny because we saw a very, I don't want to say docile, but a very watered down and mellow North Korea for quite some time, didn't we? I mean, after the fire and fury remark from Donald Trump and the activity and the kind of a rise in tensions, and then there was the meeting and the second meeting, seems like things got watered down. We didn't see military exercises for a few years. And now with the new leadership in the South and a renewed, like you just alluded to, another round of new military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea, we are seeing this legislation. This is almost a sign of the times that we're back on the tensions path again instead of the de-escalation of tensions path.
Yes, because half or so of the population of South Korea voted for the new president, and the other half voted for his liberal opponent, Kim Jong-un, who is now the leader of the opposition party, Democratic Party, and they are putting so much pressure on this conservative president. They have sued the conservative president's wife. There is a huge tension going on there between the progressives and the conservatives here in this country. It's extremely polarized. And so this current president, who knows how long he can hold on to power, until the end of his term, perhaps. But after that, we have to see what happens.
All right, good stuff. Jennifer, always a pleasure to check in with you, and do stay safe. Jennifer Chang, everyone, joining us from Seoul. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New British Prime Minister Liz Truss enters 10 Downing Street in conditions that the country is grappling with economic, energy, foreign policy and NHS crises. Whether or not she could deal with the messy situation in Britain during her tenure is the main question asked by her critics and observers these days. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media to know more about the views and attitudes about the issue. This is the second part of the article. The website of Common Dreams wrote, Labour Party members, progressives and critical voices worldwide registered concern and condemnation recently after the Conservative Party in the UK voted to make Liz Truss, formerly the Foreign Secretary, the nation's Prime Minister, to replace the outgoing Boris Johnson. In a runoff with former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak, Truss won out by a historically narrow margin following the resignation of Johnson earlier this summer amid a raging energy crisis, soaring costs, and a flood of internal scandals that sapped his support. Just when we see the back of a law-breaking parliament proroguing office-abusing PM in Boris Johnson, said Green MP Caroline Lucas in a tweet, he is replaced by climate-wrecking, handout-refusing, redistribution-opposing, Brexit ideologue PM in Liz Truss. Buckle up, it's going to be a rough ride. While Johnson leaves having disgraced his office, continued Lucas, she warned that Truss campaigned as a right-wing ideologue and will govern as such, which is a disaster for all of us. As both Foreign Secretary and International Trade Secretary before that, Truss was rebuked for her xenophobic rhetoric and policies throughout her career by human rights groups in the UK, Europe and beyond. The Labour Party made clear their belief that Truss, based on her own remarks, will continue her party's hostility toward working people in the UK. For those looking for a break from the aggressiveness of the Johnson era, progressive critics said there is nothing to look forward to with Truss. New Prime Minister, same old deceit, declared DIEM25, the pan-European political movement, in a social media post following Truss' election. Truss, the group warned, will continue to serve the British oligarchy and the global technocrats of the World Economic Forum at the expense of the everyday citizen battling with the cost of living crisis that the Tory party is directly responsible for inflaming. Labour MP Jeremy Corbyn, former leader of his party, said that Truss should act immediately to alleviate the struggles of working people. The first act of Liz Truss's premiership should be taking immediate action to tackle the cost of living crisis that is pushing millions into poverty, he said. This must be a wealth tax and bringing energy companies, water, mail and rail into public ownership. Corbyn also called for a commitment to give workers a raise in the country, stop the push to privatize the National Health Service and end the appalling treatment of refugees fleeing war. According to Guardian columnist Simon Jenkins, the best and first thing that Truss could do as Prime Minister is to immediately U-turn on everything she believes in as a person and politician. Andy Worthington, a progressive journalist and activist, suggested there was little hope of that with Truss when it comes to fighting inequality, the climate crisis, or putting the government in service of people's needs. Just when what we need is a Truss in which a number of objects combine to create a solid structure, we get instead a Liz Truss, said Worthington, adding a far-right libertarian puppet who despises the poor for being poor, adores the rich and wants to make them richer and loves fossil fuels. The website of Middle East Eye, in an article penned by Peter O'Born, wrote, Johnson leaves office as the most incompetent prime minister in British history. There is no reason to suppose that Truss will be any better. When Johnson was deposed as Tory leader and prime minister after being caught misleading MPs, I naively imagined that his successor would seek to restore the decency and integrity which Johnson had abandoned during his three-year premiership. But Truss has not sought to do that. She told the Tory membership that Johnson did not deserve to be removed from office. When I wrote to Truss and her leadership rival Rishi Sunak asking her to pledge to correct the many lies and falsehoods uttered by Johnson on the floor of the House of Commons, she did not answer. Her own leadership bid, too, has been littered with similar deceptions. Britain used to be famed for the integrity of national institutions. Truss has made quite clear that she has no intention of undoing the damage inflicted on our national reputation by her shamed predecessor. Peter O'Born of the Middle East Eye said there is reason for this. She herself relies on the forces which took Johnson to power 3 years ago. Tory party donors, the right-wing press, above all the Daily Mail, and the approximately 150,000 Tory members, including a large number of elderly who bigoted views and formerly belonged to Farage's UKIP, a right-wing populist party. It reflects extremely poorly on Truss that in order to win the Tory party leadership, she pandered to this unrepresentative selection of the British population with pledges to trigger Article 16 to tear up the Northern Irish Protocol and challenge British membership of the European Court of Human Rights. Now she faces the task of governing for the British nation as a whole. Having boxed herself in during the Tory leadership campaign, she will find it impossible. If she reaches out to the British people, as she promised in her leadership address, she will instantly be accused of betrayal by her backers on the Tory right. Peter O'Born of the Middle East Eye continued, "That is why I believe that the Tory party may well split under Truss's leadership. It's not just that she stands little chance of repeating Johnson's great electoral triumph in 2019, when he forged a historic coalition between working class voters in the north of England and the southern middle classes. Equally important, she is not liked by many Tory MPs. If she does not revive the Tory party's standing in the polls, some will despair of the party itself. The Conservative Party has now been in power for 12 years of austerity and economic failure. It has lost its way, as the election of Truss shows. Expect a series of defections to Labour in the short 2 years which run up to the general election. Truss's defeated rival Rishi Sunak has already made plain his despair at the shallowness and irresponsibility of her economic policy. He may emerge as the leader of a group of disenchanted MPs upset by her methods of government. An even more deadly threat may be Johnson himself. Considering his undignified reaction to his disenfranchisement nearly 2 months ago, Johnson and his allies will not be able to restrain themselves from scheming against Truss once she runs into trouble. And she will run into trouble. Her premiership is destined to fail. She will bring down the Conservative Party with her. None of this matters very much, except that we worry very much about the damage inflicted on Britain as a nation. Over the coming months, Britain will enter, along with much of the rest of the world, an economic and social crisis on a scale not seen since the Great Depression of the 1930s. It is hard to think of a national leader less equipped to deal with the traumatic months ahead than shallow, vapid, empty, self-admiring Liz Truss.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
The listener, Siddiqa, is a student of jurisprudence in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. So here we are to discuss another issue, that's abortion. Siddiqa, in our previous episode, we discussed something regarding abortion. We discussed what is abortion, how does Islam define it, and what are the different viewpoints, Islamic views and secular views, why Islam does not support the absolute right to abortion. Now we have a question: that does the regulation on abortion mean a regulation and control over women's body?
So this is an argument that's posed quite a lot by people who want to say that we have an absolute right to abortion.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, right now, per year, there are about 40 to 50 million abortions per year that happen. A lot of these, the arguments that are posed by those who support abortion, say first it's a woman's body, therefore she has absolute right over what she wants to do with her body.
Okay. We keep on seeing those placards, it's my body, my choice.
Exactly. While there's a truth to it in the secular world, my body, my choice, there should also be an understanding that every action has a consequence.
Yeah.
If there is a consensual relationship without the necessary contraceptives used, now I can understand there would be issues where a contraceptive would fail, but if two consensual adults get into a relationship, then they need to be aware that their relationship without the necessary precautions will have a consequence. Now, yes. That consequence is an independent identity. Just as a woman has an independent identity and an independent body, that child, that fetus as well, has an independent identity and an independent body.
All right.
Therefore, we are supposed to choose over here the right to life over the right of a woman over her body. Now, once she has, in all across the whole platform, whether it be secular or religious,
yeah,
the right to life holds greater value than the right to one's own body. If I have made a choice and I have a consequence to deal with it, whether I like it or not,
mm-hmm,
it is a result of my choices. Now, over here, we are talking about a very broad spectrum. We're not going into the nitty-gritty of what if she was raped? What if it was unconsensual,
yeah,
relationship? What if, what if, what if? We're not going to the what ifs. We are looking, as we said in the first episode, we are looking at a very broad spectrum that, yeah, viable, safe pregnancy out of two consensual adults who have entered a relationship.
Yeah.
Now, because Islam gives marriage and family planning such important value, now then they come about and say, look, you're regulating my body. That means you want to control my body. And this goes back to the idea that men want to control women's body.
All right. Now, again, Islam, those false slogans of feminism and all.
Exactly. Now, let's say if that child were to be a female, right? And if someone wants to abort the child because it's female, we would still come back with feminism, right?
Yeah.
You're aborting a female child. Feminism has its own criteria and its own discussions and views. But when it comes to regulation, first, Islam is not regulated by man or woman. It's regulated by Allah who is not gender-based.
True.
This is something that's very odd in the world today. If you call Allah he, because in Arabic, Allah is referred to as hu Allah.
Yeah.
Because the male pronoun is used, therefore they come back with the argument that Allah is a male. Why don't you call Allah with a female pronoun?
All right.
Which is rather absurd because Allah is not a human being to have a male or a female pronoun to
him. Identity, yeah.
It's just because the language has only two pronouns to use, male or female. We don't have a choice over here. So first, the regulation around abortion is by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not by male
or
female.
Not by humans. Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Yes, Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing different forms of abortion. And Sadiqa's throwing light on the topic in the different dimensions. Yes, Sadiqa.
So like we were discussing, the idea that is regulation around abortion within the Islamic framework by a male or a female. And we say this by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who is not gender-based. It's just that we use the male pronoun because language gives us only two pronouns. And using it for Allah is quite insulting.
Yeah.
Using it for any person is insulting. So therefore, the next thing is, when it comes to regulating abortion, now in the secular world, yes, there are some cases where ectopic pregnancies are regulated. Abortion in cases of rape is regulated, where women are not allowed abortion. But that's in the secular world. We are looking at the Islamic world.
So does Islam have different views, different set of rules?
Yes, Islam has very different views for every case, right? Okay. Because it is supposed to be an all-encompassing religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to regulating abortion in Islam, it is regulating the right of life of another being. It's not regulating the mother's body. This is something we need to take into account. Regulations on abortion in Islam are regulating the right of life of another child, not the body of the mother.
Okay.
Right? And when we look at it this way, then we move away from the regulating the woman's body theory. Because now the right of life of another being takes precedence over other issues around. After this, then they come with the idea that a woman has been raped. Or a 9-year-old girl was raped, as it has happened recently, where she got pregnant and giving birth to the child would put immense pressure on her that it could potentially harm her for life.
Okay.
Now, in these cases, in every individual case, Islam has its own laws.
So what does Islam say about a woman who was not actually involved with another guy in a relationship with her own choice? And indirectly, we say, like, she was raped. What if a child comes into existence over here?
So I'm going to give first a very general set of rulings, which is part of the Iranian constitution.
Okay.
As it has been
Which is
researched.
Based on Islam itself.
Yes. Now, this is a very general, okay? We'll go case by case later. But in a very general, abortions can only be performed under a few specific conditions.
Okay.
The fetus must be less than 4 months of age. And that is mainly because, like we said, ensoulment happens after 4 months, where the soul enters.
Enters the body.
And then that child is seen as a complete being already.
Yeah.
Because the primary focus in Islam is the soul.
Yes.
And there's a whole very intensive philosophical view on what the body is.
Yeah.
Right?
We would want to know more about those rules of the constitution after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing abortion. And right now she's talking about the rules of the Iranian constitution, which are in itself based on Islam regarding abortion. Yes, Sadiqa.
So according to the first one was that the fetus must be less than 4 months of age and it must be before ensoulment. Ensoulment is technically seen as occurring around 20 weeks of gestation. And then the second condition, it must be that the fetus must be suffering from profound development delay or deformations and malformations that today through science we're easily able to
recognize.
Yes. quite quickly as well. These fetal problems may also cause extreme suffering or hardship for the parents, or the life of the mother should be in danger. Because okay. like we said, in Islam, the right of life takes precedence over other choices. Therefore, when it comes to between the mother and the child, again, the right of life of the mother is given more importance over here, given that she's a fully formed external being. So there are cases of how Islam goes ahead when it comes to right of life as well.
Okay.
And the fifth must be that both the parents must give consent. So it can't be that the father is forcing the mother to make an abortion, which happens quite often, where sometimes the mother does it without the father's consent, or the father forces the woman to go through abortion. And this is not recognized because both parents have a right to the child.
They're equally involved.
Yes, they're equally involved. And obviously, when it comes to abortion as well, when abortion occurs without
the consent of mother.
Yes. Or even if abortion in general, if it occurs without the consent of the mother, it does bring about a lot of mental health issues for them in the future. And again, we need to address these issues of how women should be helped to deal with post-abortion.
And that trauma.
Yes, the trauma. And even if they are not allowed abortion, there should be some services available for them to get through this period of difficulty for them.
Tough time, yeah.
Yeah, where they're able to deal with what's to come. And in abortion itself, when it comes to Islam's view on abortion, if there's a safe, viable pregnancy and the parents do go ahead and abort the child where they're not legally, Islamically allowed to do so, the rules are quite strict on this. When I was reading through the jurisprudential rules on these issues, it says that they actually have to, according to one of the scholars like Ayatollah Sistani, who's based in Najaf, is a jurist, he says they have to give blood money to the inheritors of the child. They have to fast for 60 days and they have to seek forgiveness for abortion. And this in itself shows the magnanimity of this issue. The abortion is seen as a crime in itself.
Okay.
Such that blood money itself becomes mandatory to be given.
Oh, yeah. So, well, we saw that it becomes a crime in certain cases, but there are still certain cases wherein Islam has a different point of view. It's even allowed somewhere. So we'll discuss more about the topic in another session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Statistics and studies show the number of cases of violence with firearms in the United States has increased in recent years, especially since 2020. As gun violence ramps up during the coronavirus pandemic in America, cities also saw homicide rates rise. And that trend continued in 2021 in many of the nation's most populous cities. The American people are the most armed citizens in the world, and this estimate from the 2021 National Firearms Survey shows that about two-thirds of American adults own a gun. In this regard, we have taken a close look at some of world press and news agencies to shed more light on this matter. Please stay with us. Over the weekend, at least 9 people were killed and 48 wounded in multiple shootings in different parts of the United States. The U.S. Gun Violence Archive says more than 30,000 people have died from gun violence in the United States so far this year. According to CGTN website, in Norfolk, Virginia, police say 2 people were killed and 5 others injured by gunfire at a party on Sunday, 4th of September. On the same day, at least 6 people were injured in a shooting incident in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. In Maryland, a 15-year-old teenage boy was killed and 3 other people injured after 2 gunmen opened fire on Saturday, 3rd of September, inside a convenience store. From Friday, 2nd of September, to Sunday, 4th of September, the city of Chicago in Illinois reported a number of shootings that left 6 people dead and 34 others injured. Last year was the deadliest for the city of Chicago in 25 years, with nearly 800 homicides recorded. The News Times Daily explains more about the story, saying, "Gun and violence have become ubiquitous words. It is appalling. America is known from abroad to have a culture in which the procurement and ownership of guns lead to the pervasive killing of students, worshippers, and innocent bystanders, causing premature death in thousands of people. In the face of this prevalence, gun violence is declared a public health crisis, an epidemic of evil, with hand weapons being the instruments. Every tragic and sorrowful shooting prompts governmental action, followed by disagreements and inaction. Citizens are acting instead. Some activists want an office of gun prevention. Some communities are establishing community intervention programs, starting with young people who are on both ends of the gun, as drivers and victims of violence. U.S. Congress passed the first major gun safety legislation in years. However, even the National Rifle Association, the NRA, stated, "It does little to address violent crime." Sure, access to fewer guns by fewer people means fewer deaths, but gun violence is not going away. With so many guns already in circulation, hundreds of gun laws written and not passed by Congress, and the pressure of the gun lobby make enforcement of the new act questionable about reducing gun incidents. If using hand weapons is of epidemic proportions, efforts to mitigate it are essential. It means getting to the root of why crimes are committed in the first place. Those committing shootings that have been determined to be impulsive and immature youths and adults with problem histories, all who found ease in purchasing guns. Warning signs were there. Bullying and being bullied. Depression, adverse childhood experiences, stress at home, and an interest in violence and hatred. If these markers are identified, individuals can be assessed and managed as early as possible. Researchers about gun violence prevention can use data to identify potential threatening people. The Minnesota Reformer writes, in a country where there are more firearms than people, mass shooting incidents have become increasingly frequent, and gun violence in general is on the rise. More Americans died from gun violence in 2020, the most recent year for which there is data, than any other year on record, and gun violence was the number one cause of death for children in 2020. In the past year, the country has grappled with an onslaught of mass shooting incidents, from a 15-year-old boy shooting and killing four students and wounding seven others at Oxford High School in southeast Michigan, a gunman killing seven people and wounding dozens more during a 4th of July celebration in Highland Park, Illinois, another gunman killing 19 children and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas, the deadliest mass shooting in 2022, and a gunman and avowed white supremacist shooting and killing 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Amidst this terror, experts are grappling with why this is happening. The answer is that it is layered. There's the fact that guns are ubiquitous in the United States. In a country of about 330 million people, gun owners possess about 393.3 million weapons, and gun ownership soared during the coronavirus pandemic. The current gun violence crisis comes at a time when gun ownership soared during the pandemic and the number of white nationalist groups jumped by 55% during the Donald Trump presidency. Experts say there are a lot of guns and a lot of anger, much of which is fueled by white supremacy that spreads like a wildfire because of social media in the country right now. Following the shooting incident at Oxford High School, U.S. Democratic lawmakers called on their Republican colleagues to act on legislation meant to curb gun violence, including Senate bills 550-553 and House bills 5066 and 5069, which would require gun owners to store firearms that could be accessed by minors and children in a locked box or other secure location. Other bills, including bipartisan and bicameral legislation, Senate Bills 678, 679, and House Bills 5371 and 5372, would prohibit individuals convicted of domestic violence misdemeanor from owning a gun or ammunition until 8 years after they have paid any fines and completed their jail term or probation terms. None of these bills have received a hearing. CNN's website elaborates more on the issue, saying, gun violence is rampant in the United States, according to Gun Violence Archive. There have been at least 456 mass shooting incidents in 2022, leaving 30,237 people dead. That's an average of more than 1.8 mass shootings every day so far. The 2018 Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 393 million firearms in civilian hands in the country, or 120.5 firearms per 100 people. That number is much higher now, given the soaring increase in gun sales in the past few years. US President Joe Biden in July said that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields and vowed to reinstate a ban on assault rifles. The remarks came in a White House ceremony to mark new gun control legislation that he signed on 25th of June. President Biden said, "This has taken too long, with too much of a trail of bloodshed and carnage. The past many years, across our schools, places of worship, workplaces, stores, music festivals, nightclubs, and so many other everyday places, they have turned into killing fields." A group of parents and family members who lost their loved ones in the Uvalde school shooting incident joined gun safety advocates outside the Texas governor's mansion in Austin, Texas, recently, pleading for Governor Greg Abbott to move to raise the minimum age to purchase an assault rifle, AR-15-style rifles. With schools across Texas having already welcomed students back into the classroom, gun safety advocates are calling for the governor to hold a special legislative session so state lawmakers can vote on whether to raise the minimum age for purchasing AR-15-style rifles from 18 to 21 years old. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, has repeatedly said he would not do so. Abbott has claimed that mental health is at the core of America's gun violence epidemic, not firearms themselves. One of those parents say mental health is part of the problem, but that refusing to acknowledge that guns play a part as well is ridiculous.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.